return to a defect in the solid state. So it's a very, very common experimental platform because it's easily accessible. So the idea is to have an atomic defect in a crystalline material. And the story is simple. You say, well, the crystalline lattice is so clean and perfect that the defect, although it's atomic and within the lattice, will also be clean. Each defect will be identical, and the decoherence will be long, and we can treat them pretty much as though we had a solid state system that was equivalent to a trapped ion without having to worry about the trapping or the loading or anything else. As we'll see, of course, that's not quite the way it works out, but it's a nice motivating concept. And there's a couple of lattices that are really easy to make clean. Diamond and silicon are the obvious ones that in both cases, there's only one chemical species, of course, carbon and diamond and silicon and silicon. In both cases, there's a stable isotope which has spin zero. So in the case of silicon, silicon 28 is spin zero. Silicon 29 is spin 1.5. But it's only 4.7% abundant. And you can keep it out of your fabrication process if you wanted to. In diamond, of course, carbon 12 has no spin. Carbon 13 is spin 1.5. And the reason we would like to have a defect where there's no spin, of course, is spin represents a small magnetic moment. And so if you have a diamond and you sprinkle in C13, then you have some random distribution of fluctuating magnetic moments. And if you're really saying, I want this to be a clean system, then you'd like to keep the fluctuating magnetic moments away. Okay, but you know, let's look. Silicon carbide is another good material. There's a few other crystals that we could talk about. But the NV defect in diamond is, as you're gonna see, easy to control, and you can build a small quantum processor at room temperature. It really is a system that you can make microscopic. And so you could think about using this for a defect or a processor that you can take out to the lab. Okay. So what we're saying is it's ion-like, sort of. So the diamond lattice, of course, you'll recall that carbon has four bonds. It's a sp3 hybridized material, and it's tetrahedral. In the easiest way to describe the diamond lattice is in terms of this structure, which is an adamantane molecule, which is a nearly spherical molecule, but you know, it shows the structure of carbon, and so each carbon, of course, would have four bonds, and so I could take this as a unit cell for diamond. And the NV piece of NV says that we have a nitrogen in a vacancy. So I take out one carbon. I should have made that clear. Each corner, of course, is a carbon atom. Each has four bonds. I haven't drawn all the bonds, just the unit cell. So we take out one carbon, and we replace it with the nitrogen. Right? So there's another bond coming off here. And then I put a vacancy here. Meaning there's a location in the lattice where there simply isn't an atom. And to get nitrogen in a diamond, well, it happens naturally. It's hard to keep nitrogen out of a diamond. But I can also take a very clean diamond and I can ion implant. So I can irradiate a diamond with nitrogen and force the nitrogen into the diamond lattice, some microns deep. If I took such a diamond and I annealed it, then the vacancies would move through the lattice and they would find a nitrogen. That this is a low energy state, so they want to be together. So all we need to do is heat a diamond. And of course, you probably know that diamonds come in lots of different colors. And the reason they come in different colors is they have different defects in them. Boron, silicon, nitrogen, a variety of vacancies. So the nitrogen has only three bonds to it, and it has a lone pair of electrons. So there's two electrons sitting here. And then the carbon atom that we removed, of course, would have had four bonds to it. In each bond, its neighbor would contribute an electron from. Now here, we have our four, I want to make sure I get this sort of right, our four bonds. And each of these will have one electron. So there's going to be four electrons, but I can't count this one that comes down to the nitrogen because I've already counted it. So we have three electrons that show up because the other carbons in the lattice want to be bonded to that. And then the defect is negatively charged. So it's the NV minus. And so in total, there are six electrons at the defect. And if I wanted to describe the molecular orbitals that those six electrons span, it gets really, really complicated. But fortunately, the magnetic properties, and that's what we care about, look like two electrons with a strong exchange coupling. What that means is we have two electrons and there's an interaction which is going to swap them. So if I took these two electrons, and let's say that we're in a strong magnetic field. And of course, you'll know that electrons are spin 1/2 particles. So they have two spin states. And so if I have two electrons in a strong magnetic field, then I have four spin eigenstates labeled like so. And if I swapped the two electrons, then the only thing that happens is I drive that transition. Okay? So this transition corresponds to an exchange of electrons. And of course, if they're both up or they're both down, and I swap them, I'm in the same state, right? There's nothing interesting that happens there. And this interaction, we could write down the operator for that exchange. It's most conveniently written down in terms of raising and lowering operators. And the reason that one often sees it this way is it stresses that this is energy conserving if the two electron spins have the same Zeeman interaction. So if the two electron spins truly are the same, these two states are degenerate. And so by flipping both spins, I haven't cost the system any energy. This is equivalent, if I wrote it out in terms of Cartesian Pauli operators, to that. Now, we're not going to be in a strong magnetic field. We could put ourselves in a strong magnetic field, but we want to describe the system in all cases, including a weak magnetic field, and the exchange interaction becomes the dominant quantizing interaction. And so what we do is we end up taking these two states, and those two states get mapped into the symmetry related states. Like so, and so that we have an even and an odd symmetry for those two. Now, here what I want to do is I want to keep these two states with their even and odd symmetry, but I don't want to work in a high magnetic field. I want to work in first the zero magnetic field. And of course, once I remove the Zeeman interaction, these two states actually become degenerate. And so our energy level diagram without field looks like this, where we have this even state, which has MS, which has total spin zero, right? One spin is up. Whenever one spin is up, the other spin is down. So it has total spin zero. We have two states corresponding to up, up, and down, down. So total spin of plus one and minus one. And these two are degenerate in energy. I draw them a little bit separate, but they're degenerate in energy. So this is my energy coordinate. And this energy difference is about 3 gigahertz at zero field. Okay, it's just what the reality of the system is. And here, of course, we have a MS equals zero state again. But you would recognize this, perhaps, as the triplet manifold and the singlet manifold from two spin 1/2 particles, where the eigenstates are defined by the symmetry. Okay, so over here, I've got this odd symmetry state, and here I have the even symmetry states. Okay? Now, if I look at the Hamiltonian of this, I'm going to write it down as a spin one particle, right? It has three energy levels with with total magnetization plus 1, minus 1, and 0. So that looks like a spin 1 particle. So on this side, I have a spin 1. And of course, over here, I have a spin 0. And of course, you know from your addition of angular momentum that if I take 2 spin 1/2 particles, I add them, I can get a spin 1 or a spin 0. Yeah, that's just the same thing here. We're going to need all of these states, but this is the piece where we're mostly going to work in, right? Because here I have enough states to have some interesting physics. Now, what makes the NV system useful is that there's an electronically excited state that has a cycling transition. So we need to include the electronics, right? This is just the spin piece. So we have down here in the electronic ground state the spin piece. And then way up, this is not drawn to scale at all, we have the electronic excited state. And this transition corresponds to red light. And that excited state says, you know, just like I would take a hydrogen atom and I would excite an electron into from the 1s to the 2p orbital. It's just like that, except of course, it's an excited state that has those 6 electrons in some messy orbital. And at this point, we don't need to worry about the structure of that electronic state. We're not going to use it. If I excite with a laser this transition, then it'll fall down to the MS equals 0 state. And it will conserve the spin dependence. And that's what we mean by a cycling transition, that we can drive the system over and over again. It'll conserve the magnetization, the magnetic quantum number. And of course, each time it falls down, it gives off a photon. And so we can detect these photons. And we have some way of saying, hey, what state are we in? Now, it gets to be a little bit more complicated. If I excite the plus 1, it falls to plus 1. If I excite the minus 1, it falls to minus 1. They're all cycling transitions. And so we have this structure. And I want to use the light as a way of both pumping the system into its magnetic ground state. And I want to use it as a way of detecting. And so I want to show you how we do that. And a key feature is this lonely singlet state over here. And this is an element of why, if you're thinking about these systems, they're not quite ion-like. Now, before I do that, we had a separation here that was this 3 gigahertz, which comes from the exchange interaction of 2 electron spins. When I go up into the excited state, it shouldn't be surprising that the exchange interaction has a different structure, because now we're in a different molecular orbital. So this energy separation is different than this energy separation by a little bit. And the lifetime that you would spend, if you excite here, then you spend a random time before you fall down. You know, on average, some 30 nanoseconds, but in fact, random. And you can see that if I have a coherence here, and I excited it, but I changed the energy a little bit, and it evolves for a random time, and then it falls down, that looks like I have a dephasing, right? The spin's going to evolve at a different rate for some random time, and so it's going to pick up a random phase, okay? So our coherences are going to be stuck here. And we're going to use these other states just to detect and to prepare the system. But whenever we want to do something coherent, we're going to live down here. Finally, it's useful to say, if I looked at this photon, and I looked at this photon, ideally, they would be slightly different. And if we truly had an ion, we could rely upon that difference because every ion really is the same. But if I have a lattice, then I have phonons in the lattice, or I have other impurities or other things. And so these lines, if I measure the spectrum of this, they tend to be very broad. And there's a little feature off on the edge, which is the so-called zero phonon line, which is the line you would see if nothing else happened. And all of this stuff is because there's some vibration in your crystal. And so if we wanted to rely upon these two being different, we would have to go to low temperature so that this phonon spread, the spread of vibrations, was removed and we really had a sharp peak. Okay, we're not going to do that. Some people do for various experiments. What we want to do is to think about this at room temperature. All right. Now I want to look at these transitions. And if I want to know about a selection rule, then if I have if I have two spin one half particles, the operator for a dipole allowed transition is just label them A and B. Is that? Says you're allowed to flip one spin. Right? You're not allowed to flip two, you're allowed to flip one. So if I took the MS equals zero state and I looked at is there a transition to plus one or minus one, so then I could say, oh yes, let's, you know, just look at this in terms of the inner product of those. Then you can see that this transition, so if I was writing down Fermi's golden rule, of course, I would divide by the energy difference. Here, I only care about selection rules. I don't care about the energy. All I want to know is this an allowed transition? And you can see that the overlap, if I act on this with sigma XB, then I have an overlap. If I act on this with sigma XA, I have an overlap. So this thing is not equal to zero, therefore it's allowed. And of course, if I looked at the down-down state, there would be no difference. And if I looked at the transition between the two MS equals zero states, between the MS equals plus one and minus one state, that this is equal to zero. So this transition is not an allowed dipole transition. So if I come over to this picture, I can drive this transition, and we said it was at 3 gigahertz, and it's magnetically allowed, so I can drive it with a microwave field. And I can drive this transition with a microwave field. But the transition between those two energy levels, I can't drive with a microwave field. I still will have universal control. I'll be able to drive that transition, but not directly through a microwave field. Okay. Now, if I look at the transition to the singlet state, this is equal to zero. It's equal to zero because of this negative sign. So sigma XB acting on this, of course, will give me an overlap. So I'll get from these two and sigma XA acting on this will give me the same thing, but there's a negative sign. So this is equal to zero. And that's not surprising. We have two states that have different symmetries, and we're driving them with an operator. We're connecting them with a symmetric operator. So this is not allowed. So I can't go from the singlet over to the triplet manifold. They're two separate manifolds. And if we were talking about ions, then the selection rules are written in stone. And unless you come in and do something to change the symmetry, then you're stuck with them. When I was a postdoc, all people that wanted to work in coherent control had to take a postdoc in Holland. And my advisor, Weber, said, he had a favorite saying, the solid state is like Amsterdam. Everything is allowed. And that's why, again, we won't be ion-like. Because in the solid state, I'm not sitting with this ion sitting in some pristine vacuum. I'm sitting with this ion inside some crystal which is vibrating and moving around. And so if in the solid state we allow a small distinguishability between the two spin 1/2 particles, then the operator that we want to use introduces that distinguishability. And now then, of course, what would happen if I stick this operator up here, I would get an alpha in front of one of these and a beta in front of the other, and the difference would no longer be zero. Okay? So slight distinguishability means that these are weakly allowed. So I can go from here over to the singlet state. I leave it as a small exercise to you to show that even when I have distinguishability, these two don't connect. Okay? And of course, again, we'd have to have two spin flips in order to connect those two. So this remains forbidden. But this becomes slightly allowed. And by slightly allowed, what it really means is that one-third of the time on average that I'm exciting, I drop off to the singlet state. Okay? So it gives me a difference in the system. Now there's one more piece. And the you would think that whatever happens here must happen here. And so then I would only end up coming back to the plus and minus one states. It's not what happens. That again, there's six electrons. This pathway is complicated. And what this path leads to effectively an equal polarization of all these levels. Now, if you look in the literature, you'll usually see that the argument is that this path only goes to the zero state. And that's a convenient shorthand. But it goes to both of them. Okay. But let's see what this gives us. So I have my system. And initially, we have some population here, no coherences. We're just populated. And 3 gigahertz is a really low energy at room temperature. By what I mean by that is if I compare 3 gigahertz to the Boltzmann energy to KT, it's a very small fraction of KT. It's about 1 × 10⁴. And of course, the difference in these is given by a Boltzmann constant. So it's reasonable to say they start off equally populated. Now, if I'm driving, then I turn on my laser. So I have the population here versus time. And of course, whether we're in the plus one, minus one, zero state, it's all the same. We turn on our laser. Now, turn the laser on there. Until I turn the laser on, nothing happens. Now, if I turn the laser on, what's ever in the zero state is going to go up to the zero state, fall back down, and it'll keep doing that. And it'll keep cycling. So within this zero manifold, the states are always going to be the same. But within the plus minus one manifold, a third of the time, we're going to fall over here, and then this state is going to fall down. And I'm going to treat it as though it falls down just to zero. It really does fall down to a mixture of these. But the fact that this one isn't connected is all the asymmetry we need. And what will happen is the plus and minus one states will increase in population. And the zero state will decrease in population. Of course, the total population remains the same. And at some point, and we'll come to some steady state value where there's a big population difference between those two. And if it was this model, I could come to a steady state population that would be perfect, that the MS um, Don't listen to me, man. We're losing the MS equals plus and minus one. Two levels go down to zero. One level goes up. MS equals zero. I'm happier. We'd end up with all the population in the zero level and no population in the plus and minus one level. So by just turning on a laser, I can create on demand a population. Now it turns out that this state is long lived. So if this is 35 nanoseconds, this is about 300 nanoseconds, the lifetime. And it's described again as being dark. And dark should mean that it doesn't give off any photons. It turns out that's not quite dark. It gives off infrared photons. But since we're never looking for them, and our experiment doesn't detect them, we can treat it as though it's dark. So all the photons we get are coming from the cycling processes over here. So now then, we have state preparation. And I should say that the laser we need for this is nothing special. All we need is a little bit of power. So a laser the size of this eraser does fine. You could do the experiment if you really wanted to with a laser pointer. Okay, here we've got this piece. Now, I want to use this as well for readout. And there's two ideas I need to get across for this. The first is that you could probably see already that if the state was in the zero state or the plus or minus one state, then the amount of light that we would get out would be different. In other words, if we're in the zero state and we cycle, we always get light out. There's no chance of going over to the singlet state. But if we're in the excited, in the MS equals plus minus one state, then we only get 2/3 of the light out that we could have otherwise initially. So if I said that I have a set of populations. Yeah.
So does stimulated emission go on in these processes?
Thanks for the question. So here, we're driving the system, and the emission is strongly dipole allowed. There's no cavity. We don't need to stimulate anything. Now, in other systems, we'll need to do that. And remember that the stimulated emission rate goes as the fourth power of frequency. So as I go down in energy, then you know we need to do something in order to stimulate a relaxation. Yeah? But the energy of the photon is this red light. You know, it's not the 3 gigahertz. But it's that red light. And so that is strongly allowed. The vacuum's enough. Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
If you cycle between the plus and minus one states, because the singlet state is like 10 times longer lived, don't all of the electrons end up in the singlet? Because you said something like you get like a 1/3 loss of brightness or something, but if the
yes and no. So let me explain. we'll see in a second that we're going to set up the experiment so that there's only one defect that we're studying at a time. And so that we're going to average over many events, but in fact there's only one atom. And so one artificial atom. And so yes, once you end up over here, you have to sit there for a long time, and then you fall down and you quickly go back up. Okay? But you know, this long time is going to be an essential piece of differentiating between this and this. Okay, let me try to show you. So if I looked at the photons emitted, versus time. And if I only had the MS equals zero manifold, then the longer I looked, the more photons I would get out. We would simply keep cycling. Every time we cycled, there would be a photon emitted. And so we'd have a nice straight line. If I look, so that's MS equals zero. If I look at the MS equals plus one or minus one, then the initial slope is going to be 2/3, because 1/3 of the time we lose it. But it's going to remain like that for a time long enough that this system gets back into zero state. And once it's in the zero state, of course, it's just going to emit like it was in the zero state. And so at some point we'll have a transition, and these two curves should be parallel out there. And this time is roughly 300 nanoseconds. And it's a nice exercise to write down the Lindbladians for this and go ahead and integrate it and see precisely what that dynamic is. But you know, the piece to keep in mind that we can be precise about here is that, oh yes, if we wait long enough, we're in the zero manifold for either of these cases, and therefore we're getting the same rates of photon production. And if we look at the very short time, then the zero manifold is more likely to give us a photon than the plus or minus one manifold. And so you can see, if I'm counting out here, I'm not making any difference between the two. So I need to say, I'm going to count in some optimal window. That gives me the best distinguishability. And if we made a plot of the probability of n photons being emitted versus n, then we would have a Poissonian distribution for the MS equals zero case, and we would have a shifted Poissonian distribution for the MS equals one or minus one case. And what you would like is you would like them to not overlap. We can calculate them, they do overlap. And so you get some visibility, and of course, you make some measurement, and for a given experiment, you know, you get this value. And then you can say, oh yes, with good probability, I was in an MS equals zero state. And then over here, if I get this value, say with some good probability, if I get a value over here, then I can say, ah, I don't really know. Right? And then you can fit all these statistically. Okay? So this asymmetry in the relaxation pathways gives us a way of preparing state, and it gives us a way of detecting a state. Thank you. And of course, it's not going to distinguish between the plus one and minus one levels. It's going to tell you that you were either in plus one, minus one, or you were in zero. Okay? Good. Now I need one more small piece of data. One small piece of physics. I have a diamond. And so we have some single crystal of diamond. And there's a NV center here. And I want to study it. The NV is going to emit photons in all directions, right? So the any of these emitters are point source emitters. So you get 4 pi squared stradians. So I have emitters in all points. But I want to detect just this one. And so what we're going to do is use a confocal microscope. And so we put a pinhole here. And a pinhole is just a cheesy way of getting a focal point, right? That it defines geometrically a focal point. The light is emitted from that. We put the lens. Let me focus the light down on the point that we want to detect. So there we have a focal spot. And then this allows us, we put our laser up here, and now that we have the excitation pathway. We take this and put a mirror here, so a half silvered mirror. So some of the light goes off, and I put another pinhole here. And then I put my detector. And so now we have two paths, one for excitation, one for detection. And the con in confocal says that you arrange those two pinholes so that you're exciting exactly the set you're exciting and receiving from exactly the same spot. And so if you set up this experiment, there's a little bit of optics you need to do so that you excite and detect. Now, within this focal spot, so the focal spot is about 1 micron cubed. A little bit smaller, in fact. That contains 1 micron cubed contains a lot of atoms, right? Contains 10 to the 12 atoms. But we want within that focal spot that there's only one NV. So we want that out of those 10 to the 12 atoms, 10 to the 12 minus 1 or minus 2 are nice carbon atoms, one's a vacancy and one's a nitrogen. And it turns out that we can arrange that. That's difficult, at the point today that you can simply buy it if you want to. The challenge comes here, that we have one atom that's emitting. It's emitting in all directions. And of course, it's emitting a photon at most once every 50 nanoseconds about. And of course, if it goes in this path, it's not emitting anything for 300 nanoseconds. And so there's very few photons are emitted from this. And I can make a detector, which is a single photon detector. So I can make a detector that has a sensitivity of seeing a single photon. In fact, your eye is a single photon detector. You can detect statistically one photon. But the laser's sending in so many photons that we would never be able to see anything. And so I do two things. I shift the excitation to the green. I'm still going to detect in the red. And I put a dichroic in this case, I make the mirror actually dichroic, but I put a dichroic filter here, which reflects green, which is higher energy than red, and passes red. In a bit of magic, is if we excite way up here to the continuum of states, the system will fall down. So if I excite with green light way up there, it will quickly fall down here. This is very fast. In this process is spin conserving. So then, in other words, it happens so fast, it doesn't have a chance to learn what the spin state is. And so then the normal stuff happens. But by exciting in the green, I keep all the red photons out of the experiment unless I'm detecting them from the sample itself. And so now then, with this confocal arrangement, I can separate out the photons that I want to detect, they're red. Keep the photons that I'm going to use to excite the system, they're green. And the last little piece is this diamond. We put it on stages, up and down as well. So I can move it around until I find where there's a defect, and then we can see. Yeah? All right. So now, I want to just describe a simple experiment. And let's describe the simple experiment of saying, let's find the separation. So the first thing I do is turn on the laser. And at this point, I've prepared a state. So I've prepared the system in the MS equals zero state. Then I'm going to turn on my microwave field for some time. And the microwave field is going to rotate us from MS equals zero to MS equals plus one or minus one. Okay, and we'll look at that on Friday. So I turn on the microwave field for some time. And then I'm going to turn on the laser again. But I'm going to count. So I can tell what state I was in. And the so this is for preparation. This is for readout. This is the piece that we've been calling a Rabi rotation. So this takes 0 to plus or minus 1. I'm going to have the frequency of this as my control parameter. So I have this roughly 3 gigahertz, and so I'll start at, 2.8 gigahertz, and I'll keep stepping it. And what will we see? Well, if I look at the number of photons detected, versus frequency, of the microwaves, and let's say that this piece is the correct frequency. Well, if I'm way away from that frequency, then the microwaves won't take MS equals zero to anything. Okay, the MS equals zero state will be an eigenstate of the experiment, so it'll just sit there. So my number of detected photons will be the same, but if I'm on resonance, then I'll populate the plus and minus one state, and then through this mechanism, I'll have a reduced count of the number of spins, number of photons. So what happens is we'll go through, and we'll see a dip in that. And this dip will tell us delta in the Hamiltonian over there somewhere. So this will record the frequency in the Hamiltonian, which is from the exchange interaction. Okay. Now, there's a lot more to say, but what have we got? We've got a small diamond with a laser pointer and a photo detector. And using that, we can, with a small bit of optics, detect single quantum systems and see the statistics of it. And we have a system that's going to end up being very sensitive to magnetic structures. And so then we can use that to build more complicated devices. We could use it to build magnetic sensors, we can use it to build atomic sensors, we can use it to look at strain, stress, pressure, temperature, and we can use it to try to build quantum repeaters in networks. Okay, so we'll pick up on that, as I say, on Friday. Unfortunately, the next 2 days I'm at Yale, so Ian Hinks will talk to you about optimal control, how it's possible if you have a spectrum of Hamiltonians to still have a precise unitary for each and every element of that spectrum or that distribution. And it'll talk to you about validation. If you have a quantum processor, and of course, there's an exponential number of things that can go wrong, how do you test that nothing went wrong? Which fortunately is a precise statement out of the whole exponential number of things can go wrong. And what's the value, if you're building a processor, to having a method of testing that nothing went wrong rather than the impossible task of figuring out everything that could have and did go wrong? Okay? Any questions? Thanks.